here yesterday? I would have put him on, but he probably wouldn't know the difference. That's a little wild. So we'll just go on with this, talk more about the reproductive system. I'm going to put this a little way too late. Not too loud. I don't like hearing my own voice too much. But to show the interplay with the two layers of the follicle, okay, the outer layer, the internal cell, contains cells that are steroidogenic. They can produce steroid hormone. In this case, the steroid hormone is an androgen, androstenedione related to testosterone. The androstenedione diffuses to the granulosa cell layers. androgen. Initially, they're making androgens, and then as they go further up, they can convert the androgen to estrogen. And as the secondary follicles develop further, they'll start now making, as well as estrogen, they have the initial machinery to make progesterone. Okay, so these later follicles can make estrogen or progesterone both. The Graafian follicle, just before ovulation, makes mainly progesterone. Very little estrogen in relationship to it. When LH levels rise very drastically in a short period of time, that's when you have ovulation occurring, where the follicle releases the oocyte. Okay, just before this occurs is when the primary oocyte completes the first meiotic division and becomes the secondary oocyte. Okay, so that doesn't occur until ovulation. The granulosa cells and the theca and terna cells will then go back into the ovary and form a structure called the corpus luteum. Okay, at this stage, the granulosa cells, which were not really steroidogenic cells because they only had the aromatase enzyme, now become steroidogenic, and they can make progesterone. So the aromatase enzyme is not as active. So in the corpus luteum, the granulosa cells in the theca and terna are involved in making progesterone. Okay, this forms right after ovulation. Both the granulosa cells and the theca and terna cells in the corpus luteum now have receptors for LH. As long as LH levels are high, the corpus luteum will stay around and keep producing progesterone. When LH levels drop, the corpus luteum then forms a scar that's called the corpus albicans. It's going to be showing a degenerating corpus luteum. Eventually, it just fills in with connective tissue, and it's called the corpus albicans.
During its initial
development. It has most of the cytoplasm and proteins and the different components that are needed for the cell to develop, at least early on. Okay? As soon as this enters the, or completes the first meiotic division, the secondary oocyte starts the second meiotic division, and it only progresses to metaphase, where the chromosomes are going to line up on the mid-portion of the cell, just ready to separate to form the two new cells. Okay? So this is the cell that's ovulated, is the secondary oocyte in metaphase of the second meiotic division. If fertilization occurs, then the secondary oocyte will complete the second meiotic division and become a haploid cell. And again, when it does that, it gives off a second polar body. Okay, most of the cytoplasm goes to the fertilized ovum. Okay, when fertilization occurs, the DNA from the sperm doesn't spontaneously pair up with the DNA from the ovum, from the secondary oocyte. For a while, the two nuclear areas, they separated from each other, okay, which gives the secondary oocyte time to give off a polar body. Okay, so if fertilization occurred before this, you'd have a tetraploid, or three times the DNA, and it would have to divide again, and you'd always have twins. So it presents that if fertilization occurs, the genetic material from the male and female are separated until the female gives off its polar body. And after it does that, then the two nuclear materials fuse together to form the zygote. All right, and just going through all the stages, initially before birth, we have oogonium, the stem cells for the ovum. These are diploid somatic cells. And before birth, they go through a number of mitotic divisions. And then all these daughter cells are going to replicate their DNA and become primary oocytes. Okay, so they're going to enter the first stages of meiosis. And they stay in prophase until ovulation. And then they slowly go up to the top and still a primary oocyte. And just at the time of ovulation in the tertiary follicle, this primary oocyte will complete the first meiotic division, give off two unequally sized cells. One of them is going to be secondary oocyte that is ovulated. Well, actually, it's both ovulated because they're still sitting in the corona radiata, which surrounds them. So in the material that's ovulated, you're going to find both the secondary oocyte and the first polar body. And the first polar body can undergo its own meiotic division to complete its production of haploid cells, and these cells can be fertilized. Okay, so occasionally you can get a polar body fertilized. In that case, the chances for survival are against that individual, but you can still get an individual mate from the polar body, but it usually it doesn't occur. Okay, the secondary oocyte that's ovulated, surrounded by the corona radiata, then enters the second meiotic division, gets stuck in metaphase, and if fertilization occurs, then the secondary oocyte will complete second meiotic division, and the two nuclear regions from the sperm and the egg will fuse together. And this results in the second polar body given off. If fertilization doesn't occur, then the secondary oocyte stays in metaphase until it with that. All right, so this populated secondary oocyte gets transported to the duct system of the female reproductive system, which is mainly one duct called the uterine tube. It's also called the fallopian tube, or the oviduct, or the spalpeen, in some of the names of the different parts of the broad ligament that are attached to it. Yes, spalpeen is part of its name. The oviducts, or uterine tubes on each, off of each ovary, have four different parts to them, and they're listed here. The first part, where the secondary oocyte is transported into, is called the infundibulum. And the infundibulum has these finger-like fibria on the tips of it that hang over the ovary. The next part of the oviduct is an expanded portion that's out laterally. That's called the ampulla. And the ampulla is important because this is where fertilization usually occurs. So the once the secondary oocyte is transported about to this location, the sperm has made it up to fertilize the egg. The next portion is the part that narrows down and approaches the uterus. This is called the isthmus. And then the last part is the part that goes through the uterine wall, and that's called the intramural portion. Okay, so the infundibulum is the first part, the ampulla is where fertilization occurs, the next part is the isthmus, and then the final part is the part that goes through the uterine wall. Called the intramural portion. The uterine tube is very similar to the structure of the ductus deferens. It's a very thick wall tube that's made up of a large layer of smooth muscle. There's two types of cells inside the uterine tube, and we'll come back to that in a second. But I just wanted to show you briefly what a tubal ligation is. A tubal ligation is where the isthmus is cut apart and sealed off from each other so that the secondary oocyte can be ovulated as normally, so there's no problem with changes in hormones, but it can't meet up with the sperm. Okay, there's a barrier because the tube is missing between the two structures. The secondary oocyte will be absorbed by the epithelial lining of the uterine tube. Okay, there's two types of cells on the surface of the uterine tube. There's ciliated cells and there's secretory cells. The secretory cells are called PEG cells. The ciliated cells move the ova towards the uterus. Okay, so it helps to transport the ova towards the uterus. Okay, likewise, the four little spermatozoa that are trying to get to the ova are being pushed in the opposite direction by the cilia. Okay, so that's part of a slowing down of the meeting of the egg with the sperm. Because as the secondary oocyte is going through the oviduct in that very small portion, the secretions from the PEG cells are helping in the further maturation of the ovum so that it's going to be prepared for fertilization. So that the slowing down of the sperm to come meet the egg helps in that process. So from the oviduct, or the fallopian tube, the fertilized egg, at this point it's called a zygote because it's undergone a division, goes to the intramural portion of the uterine tube and ends up in the uterus. Okay, the wall of the uterus is another muscular wall. It contains a very thick layer of smooth muscle that's called the myometrium. The inner layer is an epithelium that's called an endometrium. This epithelium is a simple cuboidal epithelium. And surrounding the entire uterus is a continuation of the peritoneum that's called the perimetrium. Yes?
I'm asking this question a little late based on what you're talking about. When women go on fertility treatment, why is the increase in multiple births, like, you know, triplets, quadruplets, what's happening there based on the amount of, is the amount of four bodies that are being pregnant or fertilized themselves, or do you know?
I don't really know. I don't know what the fertility treatments are doing. They're probably leading to a division of the fertilization. Wall each side of the vagina, there's indentations that go up that are called fornices. Okay, each one's called a fornix. And an obstetrician, by measuring the size of these fornices, can determine the outcome of whether there be a normal labor or whether there may be some problems during the labor process. And you can measure the size of the birth canal. Okay, so we'll go back to the endometrium, which is the responsive part of this organ. It has two zones, or two parts of the endometrium. The most internal portion is called the functional zone. Okay, the functional zone contains cells that have receptors for different steroid hormones, estrogen and progesterone in particular. So they can respond to these levels of these different hormones. Because of their response, this area can go through three cycles. One's called the menses cycle, the next is the proliferative phase, the third phase is secretory. Okay, after the secretory phase, you go back to menses. So this is what's occurring during the typical 28-day cycle. Okay, the second part of the endometrium is called the basilar zone. Okay, the basilar zone always remains the same size. Its cells are deeper to the functional zone, and they're what gives rise to the functional zone, and they're what remains after the menses portion of this cycle occurs. And I'll show you that in a few moments. Okay. So just look at the general structure of the endometrium, which is this outer layer here. Myometrium made up of smooth muscles below. The basilar zone is this deeper region, and the functional zone is the more superficial portion of it. There's a lining of simple columnar epithelium that also gives rise to these glands, okay, that are located in the endometrium. They're called endometrial or uterine glands. If you look at the uterus during the three cycles, three portions of the cycle, at the initial portion of the menses part, there's very little left of the endometrium. Okay, the only thing remaining are some of the endometrial glands that were in the basilar zone. Okay, this is all myometrium down here, and this is the endometrium. During the next phase, the proliferative phase, the endometrium regenerates. So these glands that are left start undergoing mitosis, they respond to estrogen, and they replace all this material. So that now you have a return of the functional zone, which becomes very thick. The end of, here's the basilar zone down here, is still about the same size. So the functional zone has regenerated. Okay. The glands are pretty well straight. They all look like little round balls here. And that's what the typical proliferative phase looks like. And it's proliferative because these cells that remain have divided to replace the torn off epithelial layer. The last phase, the secretory phase, these glands start becoming kind of convoluted, and they're producing products, and in particular glycogen, which is an energy source for the zygote when it implants into the endometrium. Yeah?
When is it that occurs with endometriosis?
Endometriosis is an abnormal growth of the endometrium. Okay, so you've got, you may not get a normal sloughing off. Okay, you just have an overgrowth of the endometrium. Okay? So these glands are filled with glycogen, and we're only looking at the very top of this functional zone. occurs during the early part of follicle development. So we're looking at primary and secondary follicles that are responding to FSH and producing estrogen. And during that time, that's when the endometrium grows. Okay. The secretory phase is when progesterone levels are high. So now, during the latter part of the ovarian cycle, when the corpus luteum is formed, progesterone levels go high, okay, and that causes the endometrium to form this type of a structure. If progesterone levels drop, and that occurs when the corpus luteum degenerates, then you'll go back to menses, because in order for the endometrium to maintain its shape, you have to have either estrogen or progesterone. So when those levels drop, the endometrium dies off and falls away. Okay? During that breaking off, in the lower parts of the endometrium is where you'll find the endings of those corkscrewed or spiral arteries. So when the endothelium is broken off, you also have blood coming from the artery that's supplying the endometrium. So if we try to put all this together in what's going on in all the different parts of this, female reproductive system, looking during a 28-day cycle, this line here is showing ovulation that occurs at about 14 days, okay, in the traditional cycle that's presented, and we'll just keep it at that. The main control of what's going on in the ovaries is the anterior pituitary and the hypothalamus. Okay, the hypothalamus releases gonadotropin-releasing hormones at two different frequencies. If it's at a high frequency, that causes the anterior pituitary to release LH. If it's at a lower frequency rate, it releases FSH. Okay, during the first half of the menstrual cycle, the gonadotropin that's being released is at a slow rate. It eventually starts going higher and higher in its rate until just a peak occurs just before ovulation. Okay, so during this part, FSH is the main anterior hormone, anterior pituitary hormone being released. LH is at a lower level. Okay, FSH is helping the initial development of the ovarian follicle. Okay, so it's going through the stages of the primary follicle to the secondary to the tertiary. Okay, these follicles are also producing estrogen. So estrogen levels are rising as the follicles go through this progression. Okay, at the point of ovulation, just before, there's an increase in the frequency of release of gonadotropin-releasing hormone that results in a surge in LH release. And the LH release results in ovulation. Okay, at this point in time, the granulosa cells and the theca interna cells have receptors for LH. So they start to respond by producing progesterone. Okay. The remaining parts of the tertiary follicle form the corpus luteum. The corpus luteum is an endocrine organ that produces a great amount of progesterone. As long as LH levels stay elevated, these cells will produce progesterone. Okay, as the cycle continues on, LH levels start going back to their baseline level, and this cannot support the corpus luteum, so it will form a scar. As it does that, progesterone levels will drop. Okay? When progesterone drops down low, as well as estrogen, then you get into the menses portion of the cycle. GnRH released by the hypothalamus. So we try to look at this in a box-like mechanism here. If you have a decreased release of the frequency of GnRH released from the hypothalamus, this will stimulate the gonadotropes to release FSH. Initial development of the ovarian follicles as they go through the primary and secondary up to the Graafian follicle. Okay, these follicles also produce estrogen. Okay, that's one of the things that FSH stimulates besides the growth of the follicle. It will stimulate the follicular cells to produce estrogen, which has a number of effects. One of the effects is on the central nervous system. Okay, also on secondary sexual characteristics, and one other thing it has an effect on, I think it's down here, is the growth of the endometrium. So we'll stimulate the endometrium to regenerate after the menses portion of the cycle. One other thing that estrogen does is, as levels of estrogen rise, it's going to have a feedback mechanism on the hypothalamus. Okay. And what it's going to do is cause, and maybe this is the question that you were getting to up there, is going to cause the increased release of gonadotropin, releasing hormone. Okay. By increasing the frequency of release, it's going to inhibit the further release of FSH. Okay, and it's going to shift it over to producing LH, which will result in that spike just before ovulation. Another protein that's made by the ovary, the follicles, is inhibin, just like in the male system. And inhibin does the same thing. It inhibits FSH release from the anterior pituitary. Okay, so this increased frequency of gonadotropin release now results in LH production and release from the anterior pituitary, and this is going to stimulate the corpus luteum, okay, that remains after ovulation, and the LH will stimulate it to produce progesterone, and the progesterone will go to the endometrium, which we're mainly dealing with, to cause it to go into the secretory phase, where it's making glycogen that's being secreted to help support the baby. Okay. One other thing that progesterone secretion does, and I got an X here, and I'll tell you why in a second, is to go back to the hypothalamus and inhibit this increased frequency of gonadotropin releasing hormone. And by doing that, it will shut down the release of LH. Okay, so LH levels are going to drop pretty quickly after ovulation occurs, and it's no longer going to stimulate the corpus luteum to produce progesterone. Okay, in fact, the corpus luteum will start degenerating because it's not getting the LH that it needs. So towards the end of the cycle, the last 14 days, the corpus luteum disappears and is replaced by a scar. So there's no more progesterone being produced, and the endometrium is going to go back into the menses period. Okay? If pregnancy occurs, there's a blockage of this mechanism. And it's blocked, not because progesterone levels have dropped, but that there's a different hormone that's produced. And I'll tell you about that in a second. So progesterone levels are going to still be elevated and shut down the hypothalamus. All right, and if we look at what's going on during these stages, I'll clear this up in a second. The first part, the first several days of the cycle is the menses stage, where you're losing the functional layer, our functional zone of the endometrium. Okay, the young goes into the proliferative phase. See, when progesterone levels drop, then it goes back into menses, where you lose the endometrium, at least the functional layer.
Individual.